Rinpoche, a number of Western Buddhist movements are currently seeking to adapt Vajrayana for the West. The stated aim usually is to dispense with cultural trappings, religiosity, patriarchy, vertical power structures, etc. To dispense with those in order to focus on what's usually talked of as the essence. I know that this has actually been going on for 30 years or more, and it's not new, but I wondered what your views are on the current movement.
That's a rather long question, which contains many different aspects. I suppose I would start by saying that there have always been changes in religion as it moves from one part of the world to another. There were changes when Indian Buddhism moved into Tibet, when it moved into China and eventually into Japan. And the key factor with all these changes is that they took several generations to be affected. The main problem with what is envisaged is that it's expected to happen within days or hours or weeks, and that is not realistic. It doesn't really conform to any human idea of how a change can occur. You can affect a change in relatively small institutions or small ways of working, but when you're looking at a religion, you're looking at a vast collection of practices, of teachings, and to change that within a short period of time is not really possible. Especially in terms of essence and what that is and how essence is understood, how it's realized. So I would say that it's fundamentally unrealistic. That's the first part. Then there was something about vertical something, and can you enumerate these things?
Yes, dispensing with the idea of dispensing with cultural trappings.
Right.
Perhaps start with that one.
Cultural trappings. Trappings is a word that has now got negative connotations. Whether its current meaning is accepted in the dictionary, I don't know, but trappings are things that go along with something. So that if you're a video recordist, the trappings are the cables, the lights, and if you do without them, then you can't actually engage in the main task. So this word trappings is used here to mean things that are unnecessary. And I think it's really difficult to, I think it takes a long time to work out what might be unnecessary. I can think of certain things that are unnecessary, things that we might not do at Dralajong. We might not have 100 or 1,000 identical Gurumpche statues on a wall, because that is not absolutely necessary. So that's one thing I can imagine. But otherwise, one has to look at necessary in what context or unnecessary in what context. If you invite someone to dinner, you might spend a long period of time making the place look nice. You might vacuum the floor. You might clean the table. You might put on a fresh tablecloth. You might polish the silver. You might do all kinds of things. Now, none of these things are essential for eating. you could actually create a trough, throw all the food into it, and everyone could get on their hands and knees and eat it from the trough, that would satisfy everyone's appetite, but they might not come if you invite them to dinner again. So, you know, if you look at what's unnecessary, obviously, you know, making a nice atmosphere for your guests is not feeding them, but it's an important part of eating together. So when one is throwing certain things away as unnecessary, one actually has to understand their function. And the function, a great deal of the time with what's regarded as cultural, is in fact, I would describe it as art. The arts in general of, you know, music, poetry, theater, dance, these things are not essential. I mean, one could simply silence sit. But then you have a human being who has to engage in that. And human beings have many different needs and requirements. And a religion, not that I've studied world religions, I've never done that, but from the little experience I have, there are all manner of things that go along with religion. I mean, I've really enjoyed going into little country churches in Britain and seeing the hassocks that the local ladies have made with scenes of the village. And I've really been touched by that and thought, well, how beautiful that is. And the people in this village have involved themselves and they've made these tapestry covered hassocks. And that feeds people's involvement. But are they necessary? No, they're not necessary. But I was glad they were there, even though I'm not a Christian and I was just popping in to have a look at it. I found it really heartwarming to see that. So that's for the trappings. Now the vertical, what was the vertical thing?
There's the patriarchy, dispensing with patriarchy and dispensing with vertical power structures.
Well, let's deal with the patriarchy first. I think that's valid, although it doesn't always exist. I think it's the main image, but it depends how you're approaching, particularly Vajrayana, particularly the Nyingma tradition, particularly Dzogchen. I mean, I've seen far less of the patriarchy than other people have seen. Jomo Sampo Dechen Rinpoche, the Sangyum of Khunzang Dorje Rinpoche, is very important to people. She's a very important yogini as far as Dzogchen Rinpoche was concerned, you know, both incarnations that I've known. And one of the things that both Khunzang Dorje Rinpoche said and Chimi Rigsum Rinpoche said is that, you know, nuns are almost entirely better practitioners than monks, because there's no status in being a nun. So that you know that if a nun is a nun, it's because she wants to be a practitioner, not because she wants status, whereas you can't say that of monks. And they always really defended women practitioners. So I think it's a matter of what you look at. And certainly in our tradition, I think we've got slightly more female teachers than male teachers. I've never counted because it doesn't interest me to count, but I think that's correct. And now the vertical bit again, I'm leaving that to last. It sounds the most confusing.
Vertical power structures. I'm assuming that that's talking about the way in which the teacher-student relationship works is a vertical power structure within a lineage.
Oh, it's hierarchy. Yeah, I guess I'd understand that word better. Hierarchy exists in everything. If one person doesn't know something and another person does and explains it, there's a hierarchy. It might only exist for the period of time in which that is put across, but in terms of being a plumber or an electrician, unless you actually become a plumber or an electrician, those people always know more than you do. And you get them in to do whatever that you can't do. I don't particularly see a problem in that. If there's no hierarchy, then you don't need the teacher. I think that in terms of Dzogchen, well, there's certainly a saying, one of these Tibetan sayings, the higher the jhana, the lower the throne. And this is really a question of what the relationship is with the teacher in terms of how I see myself. In terms of Dzogchen, the emphasis is really on the beginningless realization of the individual. And so if that is the case, then there can't be a great difference between teacher and student. There has to be a difference, because if there wasn't one, there'd be nothing to learn. So if you're going, you can't get rid of that even in secular society. Everyone learns from somebody, and everyone enjoys learning from people. I have it in mind to write a letter to my writing teacher, Melissa Troop, because she doesn't know this, but I often mention her because she taught me how to ride. And I think she deserves some kind of national award for this, because I am the worst possible person there ever could be to learn to ride a horse. I have no sense of balance. So to actually get me to a point where I could, you know, walk, trot, canter, gallop, and even lead a group of people for a mountain ride in Montana and come back with none of them dead or injured is miraculous. And Khandra Dechen and I really regarded her as the Vajra master when it came to horse riding. We never told her this, but we did exactly what she told us to do. Whatever she said to do, we did it without question. You know, like for example, she said to me one day, how do you feel about putting the jump up? I said, you think I can do it? She said, yes, all right, put it up. And I did it. So it was simply like that. Mind you, I made her responsible by saying, do you think I can do it? Then she said, yes, right, now it's your responsibility. I'm jumping, but you said I could do it. But of course, I believed I could do it because she said I could. Because my experience of her was that she knew the combined manifestation of me on a horse. So she'd watch me go round and she would understand things from my body posture. Some of the first things she had to get rid of was the motorcycle. So I would come to a corner and I'd lean, which is all well and good on a motorcycle, but not on a horse. They really don't like it. So she had to stop me leaning. And then the next thing was, when they asked for a canter, I'd lean forwards, which is a thing you do on a motorbike. I don't know why, but everyone seems to do it. And she said, you've got to stop doing that. I said, right. Then I'd ask for canter, and the horse wouldn't canter. And then she said, you know why the horse is not cantering? I said, no, it's just because you're not leaning forwards. And that was kind of interesting. And so she said, well, this horse knows you, even from one lesson a week, and the horse knows that you're the fella who does that when you want the canter. Now you're not doing it, so the horse thinks you don't want the canter. So you've now got to reintroduce yourself as the man who used to do that, who now doesn't do that. And sure enough, it happened. And there are all kinds of things there that I sat in on the lesson one day, because I always used to go early. I used to groom my horse, and then I'd go and sit waiting for my lesson to start, you know, for one lesson to finish. And I just watched for a bit. And there was this woman who Melissa was telling her she needed to get her heels down. So my heels are down. And I was looking at her. I said, no, they're not. I didn't say anything. But I thought, well, why pay someone for a lesson and argue with them, especially when you're wrong, you know? So I found that really quite interesting. Now, the other thing, of course, in terms of this, is that it's a human and emotional situation with a teacher. You get to love and appreciate your teacher. And why I'm talking about Melissa is because this, it goes beyond the teacher-student relationship in Buddhism. It's any teacher who's really helped you. You have such appreciation for that person. And that appreciation naturally causes a hierarchy. It's not that, I mean, we also have normal conversations with Melissa. We sometimes used to go with her off to look at some horse somewhere, and we just have ordinary conversation in which we were equal. But I've also had that with all my teachers in terms of talking off topic. When Dudra Rinpoche would ask me about blues, then I'd tell him and he'd listen. There was no sense of hierarchy when he was listening to me explain something, or Chimarisma Rinpoche listening to me explain that I couldn't take photographs under these lighting conditions for him that would be any good. And he'd accept what I said because he knew I knew about photography. So that has largely been my experience. So the whole idea of getting rid of a power structure as if it was imposed for some bizarre reason, that there were some people who just enjoyed having power. Well, of course there are, but you know, it's a matter of the teacher you choose. I seem to have never spent any time with any teacher who got something out of it apart from what they were teaching. So I think this is a modern idea. I think there have been all sorts of modern ideas. Some work, some don't. There was a modern idea of calling parents by their first names. I think that's fortunately disappearing. With the idea that we're equal, but of course you and your child are not equal because you're responsible for your child. You've got to keep your child out of danger. So you issue mandates, that's what happens. And when you don't do that, you tend to get highly unpleasant children. I've known a lot of really unpleasant children. I came to a point where I thought the last thing I ever want to do is have a child. Because they're vile, pernicious little things. Finally, I once went to visit some people with my ex-wife, whilst we were still married, that is. And there was this little girl called Holly. And she came up to me at one point and said, would you read me a story? And I said, sure. So off we went to her room. She pulled a book out and I sat and read it to her. And she was very pleasant. We had a very nice time together. Then my wife and I got divorced. It wasn't Holly's fault, I should assure you. And she went to visit these people sometime later. And I visited her because I'd come to see my cat, who stayed with her because he was too old to move. And I was the only one who could remove the fur clods from under him because he was a long-haired ginger. So I used to come and snip them off. And she said, you know, a funny thing happened. I was with my friend. She mentioned them. And then Walter Holly said, where's the nice man? And I couldn't think of who she meant. It was apparently me. And I thought, me, the nice man, the child hater, you know. And I thought, I said, well, yeah, well, she was a really nice little girl. She was civilized. She was friendly. She didn't bite me, throw things at me, or act in an obnoxious way. So, of course, now we have our own children. We've brought them up differently, in a rather old-fashioned way. But they seem to like us, so it must be all right.
I'm thinking when you're talking about Melissa there, about the this idea of dispensing with the vertical power structure, or dispensing with the Vajra Master, Vajrayana without the Vajra Master, and that seems appealing to some people, it appears, currently. I was wondering if you've got thoughts about, you know, why that's appealing to people. Is it because they might have access to methods of liberation while not having to actually necessarily do anything that they don't want to do? Or what is it that is so appealing about Vajrayana without the Vajra Master for some people? And do you think that can that ever function? Can Vajrayana function without that?
Well, I think you've actually answered the question. You know, I'd really like it if there was a way to lose weight by eating more. But there isn't. That's what it sounds like to me, that I want this result and I don't want to do what it takes to get there. You know, I want to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I don't want to lift weights. It makes no sense, really. The Vajra Master is something, is a modality which is enshrined in Vajrayana. Without it, it's not Vajrayana. Really, the whole thing, one has to look at the function of the Vajra Master, and that is to override one's rationale. I think that there have been many cases of students being abused by cult leaders, and I think this has played into this. There's a whole question there of devotion. Some people really like it, other people don't like it. Most people don't seem to understand it, which is why I always talk about how one would be with some other kind of teacher, like, learning an instrument from, you know, learning cello from Pablo Casado, for example, would be an amazing thing for a cellist. And there's a sense of devotion there. They probably don't talk in terms of devotion, but there's respect there. And there's a great deal of affection there for such a teacher. Now, devotion, usually in the West, in relation to Tibetan lamas, has more to do with falling in love with a lovely old Asiatic gentleman. There's a lot of romance going there and a lot of projection, which is problematic. And it tends to fall apart as soon as the lovely old fellow tells you to do something you don't want to do, or tells you that you're an egomaniac, or whatever he or she has to tell you. So really, devotion can only be based on practice, on experience. Now, in my time of writing, I really learned a lot that made me appreciate how good other riders were. I used to watch the lady who Sarah, who owned the stables, you know, cantering just as an exercise in the outdoor arena. I used to look at her. She may as well have been reading a newspaper as she was going around. You know, she was so totally relaxed. And I thought, that's astonishing. I'd seen people canter before and I hadn't made anything of it. So the better I became at riding, the more I was able to appreciate people who were better than I was. And that just kept going. So you can't actually have devotion unless you have experience of practice that enables you to see the teacher as being something special, not simply because they're a lovely old person in a robe. That's completely nonsense. You actually have to have experience. So what the devotion is a heightened level of appreciation based on knowledge and experience, just as it would be for a cellist, guitarist, or anybody who has gone into any area of skill and advanced with it. They'll be able to appreciate people who've gone further, whereas they wouldn't have done before. Anyone can enjoy good music, but if you actually understand something about music and its technicalities, you appreciate it more through having knowledge about it. So in terms of wanting to do without the Vajramaster, I don't know how I would have done without a riding instructor. Because I'd still be leaning, going around corners, because no one would have told me I shouldn't do that. So how do you proceed in that way? When you respect a teacher, there are these two terms. There's faith, and then there's learning faith. And learning faith is what is meant when people talk about faith in terms of Buddhism. Now, everyone uses learning faith, whether they're Buddhist, religious, Christian or not. Learning faith is when someone says something to you and you go with it because you trust them. So you tell me, this is a good restaurant. I go there, I enjoy the meal. So next time you tell me this is another good restaurant, I'll say, oh, I'll give that a try. But if the first one, the meal was disgusting and the service was appalling, then I won't trust you again. So that goes with the teacher. When you follow advice and it works out, and you follow it again and it works out, you build up an expectancy of it working out. So you're more likely to do something that you don't understand. And that happened a lot with riding. I was having to do things that I didn't immediately understand. There's one particular thing with having the heels down in the stirrups. It feels as if you're going to slip out of them. It's not an intuitive thing to do, but it actually keeps you far more tightly wedged into them than otherwise, if you've got your foot in what seems to be a more solid position. It's not. You can lose those stirrups quite easily, but if your heel is down, you've got a lot of pressure on that stirrup, and it's keeping it in place. There are so many things that are not intuitive that you have to take as an instruction. And if you have enough confidence in the teacher, then you'll go there and do that, even though you don't understand what you're doing. You know, it's like skiing also. My brother was teaching me to ski, and he said, you know, in order to slow down, you've got to lean forwards. So you're on these skis, And there's this horrifying slope, which is actually the nursery slope I was on. It wasn't that horrifying at all. It was just nothing. And I see, all right, I'm going to lean forwards, which is the last thing I want to do. Now, what I want to do to slow down is lean back. And when you lean back, what happens is you lose contact with the tips of the skis. They wander all over the place. They hit some lump and one foot goes off in that direction and the other. So it doesn't work. So there are all kinds of things of that nature that are not intuitive, and you need to do things that you feel are wrong. I shouldn't be leaning forward because that's the slope and that's dangerous, leaning forwards. I need to be safe by leaning back, and that is the complete opposite of what one should be doing. So there are many examples like this. So I think that the idea that you can get it all from a book or all from information, what interests me is why these people are teachers when you may as well get it from a book. Why are there these sort of pseudo-egalitarian teachers when it could all be got from a book? Because if you don't have the Lama, you may as well get it from a book. Cheaper. Read it in the comfort of your own home and do without the teacher completely. So I'm not sure what they're saying when they're putting themselves in the position of being egalitarian teachers, just imparters of information. I mean, personally, on that basis, I would recommend people read my books, not listen to me wittering on, because I'm far more succinct and polished as a writer than I am as a speaker. I mean, why bother? How's that? Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. But this is making me think about when you talked about devotion. I've also heard it said, or written probably, recently, that the days when practitioners have been able to develop devotion for the great lamas of the past, that they're over, because those people talk about the fact that, you know, that there aren't lamas like that anymore. And also, along with that, actually, that modern day practitioners, particularly in the West, lack the capacity for devotion. But it seems that you're saying that, well, everybody has it, because that's what all learning faith outside of religion is based on as well. So it's a misunderstanding of devotion.
Yeah, I would completely disagree with that. I don't think there's any difference at all between now and then, or now and later. If you get interested in anything, if you work at it, if you get instruction from somebody who's expert in that field and has gained world renown in that field, someone like any of, you know, the great musicians, then that devotion is going to arise. The problem is calling it devotion, really. It's a problematic word because it means it has all these connotations for people, but it's really simply heightened appreciation. And you get that because of your own involvement in whatever area it is. You only play music because you love music, and you only play the cello or the guitar or whatever because you love that instrument, and you're completely involved. It is your life. And therefore, it's going to have a high level of emotional charge with it. And that when that is an educated appreciation, then that is really quite powerful. And so there's no reason why what people are saying when they say those lamas don't exist now and the audience isn't there, they're not explaining why. It's all very well to say that, but you've got to be able to say why. Because of global warming. We're all too warm to do that now. I mean, there's got to be some reason that's put forth, not just it was better back then. I mean, people of my age will say, well, the music was better back then. We had the good music in the 60s. It's now rubbish, but you know, that's spurious because everyone likes what they like. So there's no validity in that argument, or if there is, it needs to be reasoned as to why that is the case. Not just that is the case,